This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about crime and science. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Science historian Sharona Pearl is interested in faces. She's researched physiognomy,
which is the study of facial features and their relationship to character.
She's written about face transplants. She teaches at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and she was working on a new book about face recognition. She was tracking down stories of people trying to avoid law enforcement by taking drastic steps to change their appearance. Everything from people trying to dodge modern face recognition software to a famous British train robber, Ronnie Biggs, who got plastic surgery
in order to evade the authorities after his massive train theft.
As she got deeper into this kind of research, looking for more examples of people changing their faces, using search terms like
criminals and plastic surgery,
she stumbled upon something else entirely.
This whole other world turns up.
What she found blew her mind.
All of these studies written from the 1950s through as late as the 1980s about programs in prison that gave people plastic surgery as a mechanism to lower rates of recidivism.
That's right. Plastic surgery for prisoners. Nose jobs, ears pinned, chiseled jawlines, tattoo removal, all sorts of cosmetic procedures in an effort to give people a chance at a better life.
Somehow, if their looks were changed, they would be less inclined to commit crimes and return to prison after they were released.
And this went on till about 30 years ago. Sharona was shocked and intrigued.
Yeah, it was like holy forking shirtballs.
Plastic surgery as a path toward rehabilitation sounds dubious, right? But it's just one of many ideas that's been tried in an effort to reduce crime. These programs ran the gamut from highly structured partnerships between prisons and medical institutions to what were essentially handshake deals. Sharona Pearl says usually the surgeries were done as a reward for good behavior. Most of the patients were men, most of them white. This was before the war on drugs, and prison populations were much smaller and much whiter during these decades. As she was researching this strange practice, one name kept popping up.
Dr. Harry Glassman, and he had organized a pilot project to offer plastic surgery to recently incarcerated people once they were released.
That was decades ago, but it turns out Harry is still practicing. He's a prominent plastic surgeon in California, a favorite among the stars. Here he is on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, counseling Kris Jenner about breast surgery.
Hi.
Nice to
see you. I have been looking at boobs for weeks. You did my boobs in 1989. That's 23 years ago.
Right.
That's crazy.
Reporter Jed Slayman decided to give Harry a call.
Okay, so yeah, we're just rolling on just the audio right now. So thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. How did you dig up this story from God only knows how long ago?
Actually, I didn't dig it up. It was an interesting story.
I told him I didn't, actually, that Sharona did. He tells me the story as he remembers it. He says he only did some 40 operations himself, and his patients were all women. It started when he saw an article in the LA Times about how recidivism had reached about 70% in area corrections facilities. He was shocked it had gotten so high.
And so I just wondered whether helping people improve their appearance or fix their scars or remove their tattoos or improve their self-esteem, whether those things would help somebody turn their life around and would change their recidivism rates.
He reached out to the LA County Sheriff, proposed a kind of experiment. He would perform surgeries free of charge on select women from the county jail, and the sheriff would track who stayed on the straight and narrow. The sheriff agreed on two conditions.
The first was that I was not permitted to operate on them while they were incarcerated, and that we agreed that the surgery would have to take place within 2 to 3 weeks after they were released from jail. And then the second stipulation was that we did not include in the group prostitutes for fear that improving their appearance might only aid their prostitution, and that would skew the statistics on recidivism.
The jail didn't house the hardest of hardened criminals. It was mainly people convicted of minor robberies, assaults, frauds, forgeries, but no murderers or kidnappers or anything like that. Harry would visit once a month.
They would post a questionnaire on the bulletin board whether you were interested in seeing me. And each time that I went there, there might be 60 or 80 different women who wanted to meet with me. And I'd meet with them for like 5 or 10 minutes apiece. And I would pick out two or three of them that I thought were really good candidates.
Good candidates meant a combination of, did they have something Harry thought was fixable, a scar, a tattoo, a crooked nose, or out their ears? And did they seem like they were serious about changing their ways? Harry tells me about one inmate. He can't remember her real name, but he remembers what everyone called her, the bird.
There was something about this girl that she was the leader of one of the gangs in the jail, and her nose was horrible. I mean, her nickname was the bird because of her nose. And so, you know, she had a real attitude problem. Even though she had an attitude problem, I kind of liked her, and I didn't exclude her from the project.
The bird was selected, and so a few weeks later after her release, she went to Harry's Beverly Hills office, sat between all the rich and fabulous ladies who were paying full price. Harry performed a rhinoplasty on the bird, your classic nose job.
It really changed her appearance in a very positive way. And of all of the, say, 40 that I operated on, I never heard from one of them afterwards, except this young woman stayed in contact with me for maybe 15 or 20 years.
She ended up turning her life around, starting a family, having kids. She was a success story, but she was maybe the only one.
How successful was this, though?
Yeah, it was very successful from the standpoint of the outcomes of the surgery. However, the project proved that the recidivism rate did not change. When the sheriff compiled all the statistics of these 40-some women, he reported back to me that within 3 years, the recidivism rate was 70%, which is exactly what it had been prior to my doing this.
Harry had not moved the needle at all. He was disappointed, of course, and he was surprised too. But perhaps he shouldn't have been. There was at least one experimental surgery versus recidivism effort before his program. It took place at Sing Sing Correctional Facility in New York with doctors from Montefiore Hospital. Here's historian Sharona Pearl again.
And that one actually did have a federal grant behind it. And the people in the prison population who were accessing these services were divided into four groups.
The groups got a mix of vocational services and surgery or no intervention at all.
Overall, if you look at the numbers, all the numbers, it seems to indicate that plastic surgery and vocational services is better than nothing at all. But surprisingly, in some of the groups, people who got vocational services and no plastic surgery actually did better from certain perspectives in terms of rates of recidivism. And it depends how you slice and dice the data.
So the evidence in support of this kind of thing was never that robust, but Sharona explained it was kind of seen as an obvious good. The surgeries to Harry, to many of those doctors carrying them out, seemed altruistic.
I think there's a real lack of cynicism and a lot of sincerity in these projects. And in my research, I look into the really challenging bioethical breaches that these experiments engage with. But let me say that I think the people who were doing it genuinely believed that they were offering people the opportunity to better themselves. And perhaps that's not wrong.
Sharona notes that some of those prison plastic surgeons were the same early proponents of gender-affirming surgery. They were seen as kind of the bleeding hearts in their day. There is, though, the obvious ethical thorniness of essentially experimenting on a prison population, a group of less than free, quote-unquote, volunteers.
It did seem to be desirable, but it's still wrapped up in a whole lot of coercion, right? If a guard says to you, here's something that I think you should do because I think your looks are incredibly problematic, is your desire to participate in that something that you want to do, something that you need to do? I think that these are really tricky questions when you're dealing with a vulnerable population who doesn't have a lot of freedom.
Maybe you never even noticed your nose was a little bit crooked before a guard, a person in charge of huge parts of your day and your life, told you it was kind of funny looking. The strange thing about all this to me isn't that it went on for so long. It's that it went on in so many places all across the country, even in Canada and the UK.
The British case is interesting because there the advocates were actually saying that on a sentencing board, you should actually have a plastic surgeon, and in fact, a plastic surgeon over a psychiatrist. And in fact, if you get plastic surgery as a young adult in the borstal, the juvenile system, that ought to be counted as against your sentence.
Appearance was so closely tied to crime during these years, and I didn't realize just how tightly until a helpful criminologist on Reddit sent me a strange academic paper from the 60s. It appeared in the British Journal of Plastic Surgery titled The Quasimodo Complex.
Clinical facts that are widely accepted. The question is it possible that physical abnormalities may produce emotional illness?
The authors talk about rising crime rates in the United States and wonder if correctable facial deformities are at least partially to blame. They defined a handful of what they considered deformities.
Protruding ears, nose deformity, receding chin, scars,
eye deformity, and a miscellaneous section. They looked for these markers in police mugshots from several city police departments, and from there, they believed that they had found all these connections. Suicide, which many states considered a crime at the time, correlated with nasal deformities. Protruding ears were common among murderers, acne scars among rapists. They write about criminals they refer to as the sex deviant.
Evaluation of deformity in this group, both male and female, has shown an overall incidence of deformity of 56.9%, with an unusually high percentage of protruding ears and receding chins. These two deformities can play an important part in the individual's development. The protruding ear is a source of jest from childhood, and the individual with a receding chin has been characterized as weak and untrustworthy by public prejudice.
Their survey found a 40% higher incidence of facial deformity among criminals. They concluded saying this isn't conclusive proof. They can't say a crooked nose makes a crook, but they did think their findings added a bit of evidence in support of that idea. This idea that appearance and criminal behavior are related goes all the way back to the beginnings of the field of criminology. I talked about that with Kevin Thompson, a professor of criminal justice at North Dakota State University.
And I don't know if you've ever taken a criminology class, but one of the first things we ever cover in an introduction to criminology course is the idea that criminology got its start when a physician named Cesar Lombroso in the 1870s began to uncover this idea that most of the inmates he was examining in prison populations were physically unattractive people. He actually referred to them as atavists, where they had missed the evolutionary line. And he felt that as a result of that, they were morally defective people.
Lombroso came up with terms like criminaloid, which he considered a born criminal. He thought your appearance was your destiny. Kevin actually found out about prison plastic surgery while it was still happening in Texas in the late 80s. He heard doctors from Baylor Medical Center were doing this, and after poking around, found out that it was happening in at least 20 other states.
We don't know how long this had been going on. I wrote the article in the late 1980s. My guess is based on the data I was able to gather that this had been going on for at least maybe 15 to 20 years before I started doing research on this topic. So we have no idea, you know, how many inmates have had plastic surgery performed on them. You know, it could be 4,000, it could be 80,000. We have no idea.
Modern privacy laws, HIPAA, make it incredibly hard to look into this now, retrieve these records. I told Kevin I'd make some calls. Hospitals, universities, prisons, try and track some leads on former prisoners who went through this. He told me, don't get your hopes up.
Don't be surprised, Jad, if you run into roadblocks. This is not a topic that people feel comfortable talking about, but you can at least make some inquiries.
I did a lot. And not much. The closest I got was Harry, that plastic surgeon out in L.A. It could be that all this was just too long ago, or maybe people just don't want to talk about it. That's what Kevin thinks.
For us to admit and go back and say, you know, this is what happened, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago, this was a regular routine. A lot of people don't want to talk about that.
Kevin thinks these efforts were well-intentioned, but perhaps misguided. The focus on appearance and how it correlates to crime was, excuse the pun, really only skin deep. Kevin and most modern criminologists now think how people in prison look was just the end result of much bigger, more complicated parts of their lives.
I mean, it's kind of a triple whammy in some ways, that you combine genetics with this impoverished background, and then you end up in a lifestyle where you're involved in a lot of, you know, scuffles and fights and just kind of rough upbringing. So all of that, I think, just adds up as these people go through life.
So what's more valuable than plastic surgery, more likely to keep someone out of prison than walking out with a new and improved face? Kevin says it's simple. Education, job opportunities, even joining a church. In short, a pathway back into society on the outside. So there was the lack of regulation, a flawed link between appearance and crime at the heart of early criminology. That explains part of this story. But I wondered what attracted surgeons, plastic surgeons in particular, to this kind of work, to trying this out.
Before you become a plastic surgeon, Jad, you have to go through general surgery.
That's Harry again, the Beverly Hills plastic surgeon.
So what are you seeing in general surgery? You're seeing people with cancer, gunshot wounds, stabbings, life-threatening illnesses. And so during your training as a general surgeon, you save people's lives, you lose some people's lives because you couldn't get them through the stabbing or the gunshot or the cancer. So there's a very different background until after you have to go through that, and then you go into plastic surgery. So, you know, when you've saved people's lives from cancer or, you know, an auto accident, and then you start making people's noses smaller, you sometimes reflect on it in a very unusual sort of way.
Harry says he knows cosmetic and reconstructive surgery make huge differences in people's lives, but it's easy to forget that sometimes.
Every once in a while, I struggle with being a plastic surgeon because I start to think to myself, what am I really doing, you know?
Maybe these surgeons wanted to feel more like the surgeons they used to be. They couldn't save lives, but they could preserve liberty. They could make what felt like a real difference, and they could do it in average people's lives, really in disadvantaged people's lives.
I was touched by the humanity of it because some of them were just people that got caught up in the system, people who were desperate, sort of like the concept of there but the grace of God go I, you know, like they weren't horrible people. They just were, I felt like they were victims of society.
Straightening a nose, pinning an ear, perhaps some doctors hoped that could fix something wrong with society more than with their patients. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.